It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
If you were a filmmaker and could make a movie about anything related to the evolution of food, what would that be? For me, it would not be about GMOs because the proponents and opponents of the technology just keep getting more dug in on their point of view. There's no meeting of the minds. Well, fortunately, not everybody feels the way that I do on this. When the Institute of Food Technologists connected with award-winning documentarian Scott Hamilton Kennedy, they offered him the opportunity to choose the food subject he would focus on and offered him total control of the film. He chose GMOs. The result of this endeavor is Food Evolution, an in-depth evaluation of genetic engineering that was narrated by StarTalk's Neil deGrasse Tyson. When the film premiered in San Francisco at the Roxy Theater, I was there. And by a show of hands in the theater, the film changed the minds of a large percentage of the audience. Following the film, there is a panel discussion and questions. We begin this podcast with comments on stage at the Roxy by the filmmaker Scott Kennedy, Pamela Ronald, geneticist from the University of California at Davis, and Michael Dimmick, president of Roots of Change. I was especially glad that Michael and Pam were here because I moderated a panel with them on GMOs several years ago that was a great conversation. After the panel discussion, we go out on the street in front of the theater for a final conversation with Scott Kennedy about his film. But first, here is Scott speaking to the audience before being joined with remarks from Pam Ronald and Michael Dimmick.
I'm a filmmaker. I started in music videos. Maybe a handful of people might remember the Marin band called Psychofunkapus. Anybody? Come on, give me one person. Yes? Hell yeah! My first music video, Psychofunkapus, a mediocre Chili Peppers ripoff band. And then I got into documentaries after moving to Los Angeles. My liberal Bermuda Triangle is Berkeley, New York City, and Los Angeles. If you want to do it that way. And I got into documentaries through meeting my then-girlfriend and now wife, who teaches high school in Compton and still teaches high school in Compton. She's been there for 20 years. And she wanted to put on the first play there, and they were doing Our Town. And they didn't have a theater, and they put it on the cafeteria. And I knew the play and how wonderful it was, and that became my first film. And I won't go through the whole list of all my films. My second film, maybe some of you got to see, called The Garden, about the largest community garden in the country and its struggle for survival. Thank you. And so let's jump ahead to why the hell I made this movie. I was approached, IFT, which you hopefully saw in the credits, and there's a full page of this on our website to know the history of the film. IFT is the Institute of Food Technologists, and they are a nonprofit group of food scientists. And they are about 18,000 members from around the world, and they were having their 75th anniversary. And to celebrate that, they did a series of 75 articles, which are actually excellent. You can go find that. I think it's called futureoffood.com or .org, but you can find those. And they wanted to make a documentary as well. So they reached out to about 12 different documentarians and said, can you come to us with an idea? The biggest umbrella that they put on it was 9 billion 2050, basically. What are we going to, the population's going like this, racing from 7 billion to 9 billion by 2050. How are we going to feed those people safely and sustainably? That was the umbrella. I'm like, that's too big. When I teach documentaries, I go like this. Tell me your idea. I'm like, I want to make a movie about the environment. It's like, okay. So that was their big idea, and we filmmakers went away and came back with ideas. I went away with my producing partner on this project, Trey Sheehan, and we researched a lot of things. Food waste was really, really interesting, and I've become a bit of a food waste Nazi that we can talk about later. But the GMO story was just waving its hand, saying this is a story about science, about food, about sustainability. It has elements of first world and third world, and it's very, very controversial. And the more we dug into it, it's like, wow, this story is not being told correctly. Some of my fellow documentarians have done a mediocre job to, in some cases, a horrible job of representing this conversation, and we can talk about that. And to the point where when we were bidding with IFT, Trace and I looked at each other and go, well, if we don't get the job, we're going to sure go make this move. The most important thing to know about the relationship with IFT is that I said from day one when they contacted me, I'll tell you how cynical I was. I went and looked them up and I was like, oh, they're scientists and they're industry. I thought they literally contacted the liberal documentary filmmaker to just hear what I said. And they weren't going to hire me. They're like, they just want to know what ideas I might have. And then I met with them and they were sincere. And I said, guys, there's one very important thing before you ever think you might give me this job. If I don't have Final Cut and complete creative control, we can stop talking. And they understood that. They understood it, especially as scientists, right? And I just hope you guys realize how much I did not take this project lightly. I didn't go, oh, let me just make a movie about GMOs and hope it goes well. I had friends that looked at me sideways when I first took this project. I had a friend that was an executive producer on The Garden talk to me at my dining room table and say, oh, that's interesting, Scott. I hope you're not talking yourself into a paycheck. That's how strong his confirmation bias was. He didn't look at this person who he loves and respects and knows my children and go, wow, that sounds complicated, Scott, and I don't currently, I think GMOs are horrible and I hate Monsanto, but I look forward to seeing your film. He couldn't even say that. So there was a letter that was started from UC Berkeley, and maybe some of you saw it, that called the film propaganda. One big problem is that, I don't know the exact percentage, but at least 80% of them had not seen the film. And if we can't all agree that that's a fail, calling something propaganda that you haven't seen is a fail. The second part, and this is where I'm making some lemonade out of Trump, I feel pretty confident that most of us in this room we won't get into how horrified we were when he got elected, but let's get very specific. We're frustrated by things like alternative facts. We hadn't heard that term before. Or we're frustrated when he says fake news. So I say to somebody that calls me a propagandist that is frustrated with Donald Trump saying that's fake news, I'm frustrated if somebody says that my film is propaganda. So how do we know? How do we know if Donald Trump isn't right and it is fake news? How do we know if you're not wrong calling me a propagandist? And we do have a way to determine that, and it's called data and repeatability and respected institutions coming in and saying which is which. So that's what I'd like to say, and I've also put out an open invitation to anybody from that letter that would like to debate me publicly about is the film propaganda or not. So the good news is it's a term that I learned in Hawaii, the vocal minority and the silent majority. So luckily a very much louder group of people are saying that they are grateful for the film, scientists around the world. And anyway, it's just been an incredible honor to give voice to people that have been working their butts off to try and tell the truth about science.
Michael Dimmick, Roots of Change. We're a food movement organization, been in active in the state of California and nationally for about 12, 13 years. What brings me to this stage is that we have been active, have an active voice around GMOs, primarily in the areas that have to do with transparency, labeling fight. That was the place where we weighed in the most on this issue. And we've had a very nuanced position, and I got a lot of flack for being here tonight from my crowd. But we're okay with that.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So I'm Pam Ronald. I am from San Mateo, and I did my PhD at UC Berkeley, and I've been a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology in the Genome Center at UC Davis for 25 years. And I have always been interested in food and farming and fell in love with genetics. And I decided to study rice, devote my career to the study of rice, because it's a staple food for more than half the world's people. So I study genes that make rice tolerant to disease or tolerant of stress. I felt like this big burden had been taken off my shoulders and placed on Scott's shoulders. So it's so, as a scientist, you know, we were a little skeptical when we met Scott, like, what, you're going to do a film? Yes, what everybody says, and, you know, usually get the science wrong. But clearly, Scott and his team really spent a lot of time trying to get the science right. And as a scientist, it's just so wonderful to have a creative director and team put out a beautiful movie and that gets the science right. So as scientists, we're not known to be fantastic communicators, so you can hand it over to Scott now. So I'm very relieved.
How about you, Michael?
Yeah, I had, it's interesting, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I had kind of a mixed reaction. The science piece I liked. I liked the science piece because that's not the piece that we fight about. And so I felt good about it. I felt actually kind of relieved too because I don't have. It's like, okay, wow, I don't have to worry about that as well to weigh in on that stuff. But I felt disappointment because the things that I care about weren't really taken off in the film, except for in a peripheral way. The solutions to those challenges, which you talk about in your sections, did not really get taken up in the film. And so I felt some disappointment around that. The power dynamics and how you deal with that.
The thing that really is beyond below all of this is the distrust issue. And those are large cultural issues, political cultural issues that are at play and a major dynamic. I know that we talked about this 6 years ago in a little debate we did online, and that was, it was the same problem then, and nothing has really moved in that area. We're not talking about power dynamics. We're not really talking about the roots of the ability for a corporation to basically patent something, change a few genes, and then claim the ownership of that product, which is really the product of billions of years or millions of years of evolution. So there are deep issues that haven't really been taken up. And I don't know anyone that's leading a conversation that's headed toward a solution around that.
So I have a healthy skepticism of big and corporate. I mean, I grew up in the Bay Area, so you got to have that healthy skepticism. Although my whole hometown is now big Google, right. Facebook, big corporations. So there's one thing that I think gets a little bit lost that maybe hasn't been discussed. So there is big corporate patents in hybrids, and there's now down to maybe three major seed companies. They absolutely control a lot of the seed. And there's a lot of interesting discussion to be had about that in the United States and in Europe. But in the less developed world, so I work on rice, so I get to just like skate over all that stuff. Because I work on rice, which is a subsistence crop. It's a self-pollinating crop. Farmers are not buying hybrids from seed companies. They are looking for rice seed that can enhance their productivity, and they produce just enough grain to feed themselves and their families. So one thing that I think is important to keep in mind, that for subsistence farmers, the seed is a scale-neutral technology. So whether it's genetically engineered or developed through a conventional approach, the power of the seed is a scale-neutral. You can have a tiny plot of land and can reap the same proportional benefits as if you're a large landowner. And so I think that's important to keep in mind, that there are certainly issues with patents and hybrids, and it's a very valid question. Do we want only three seed companies selling seed to farmers? And keep in mind that organic farmers also buy the seed from the same seed company. So it's not organic versus conventional. That is something to be discussed. But as a geneticist and as a husband who has a farmer and who's been to met farmers that have been planting rice that I've contributed to, I'm really happy to see scientific breakthroughs and innovations that can benefit even the smallest farmer.
Yeah. I have never argued vehemently against scale. It's not about scale. It's about paradigm. And the concern that that also wasn't really spoken to in the film is the idea that when you are supporting the idea of monocultures, you are inhibiting resilience. Because monoculture, why did that happen in the papayas? It's because they were growing papayas in the same place for a long time, perhaps, where they didn't have a lot of crop diversity. When you concentrate, you build pests. Was brought up in the film. So that's a concern when you have genetically modified crops and you can do it on mass scale. Are we really dealing with the issue of resilience to pests over the long term? So that's one thing that I think is important. I want to say something that I really liked about the film. The whole thing on confirmation bias and the question that was asked, when was the last time you changed your mind about anything in the last year? That was like the best part of the film, because in the debate, this debate, no one's changing their mind, really. Very few people are changing their mind, and it's a real struggle, and that's a problem.
And so I want to strongly agree and slightly disagree with what you said. So it's it's absolutely true. As a plant pathologist, the first thing we learn is that if you have genetic uniformity, it makes a crop vulnerable to epidemics. So that's absolutely true. But as a geneticist, what we're doing is introducing genetic diversity. So we're taking, whether it's a gene from an ancient rice variety and bringing it in, or a wild species of rice and bringing it in, which is what I do in my lab, or even farther out, like taking a gene from a virus and putting it in a papaya, you're actually bringing in genetic diversity. But at the same time, genetic engineering produces seed that, in a sense, are no different than any other seed. So for a farmer, whether it's genetically engineered or not, if it's good seed that's giving them high yield and they don't have to spray something, they're going to plant a lot of it. So genetic engineering, per se, doesn't really change the very important questions about monoculture.
On the west side, Westland's the largest industrial agricultural place on the planet, talking with farmers about the situation, and it's a screwed up situation. The water's messed up, the soil's messed up, there's all kinds of problems. So the question is, what are we going to do? And I think what we've got to do, I want to disagree with you a little bit. I have seen large-scale farms that have built in mass diversity, beautiful forms of diversity. So it can exist. And in fact, we have to get to that. And we have to get to an agriculture that is constantly working to refurbish the soil, because without that, all bets are off. And soil is in deep trouble right now. And the truth of the matter is, I'm waiting to see, is there a genetically modified effort, or is there an effort with genetically modified crops to take on some of those issues? I applaud the work that's going on around water. I think that's really great. Drought. I think the whole story about the banana is awesome. What happened with the papaya is awesome. Those are the kind of solutions that have to be integrated in eventually, when we can build enough trust. And still, we haven't got to the issue of what is going to create trust. That is the key issue.
So we absolutely need innovation. And it's so interesting to be in the agricultural community where there's such a conflict about innovation, and yet we're, Silicon Valley here, and it's all about innovation. And so I think it's absolutely important to think forward, and I agree with the other two speakers, is that the discussion about genes in our food is a huge distraction from these enormous issues, not only feeding the world, but guarding the soil fertility. We have very serious problems with land and water, phosphorus. It's absolutely true. We need to build resilience into systems. And this is really where we need all kinds of tools, every kind of tool, whether it's a organic farming technique or a genetically engineered crop. So there's no absolutes when it comes to farming. So farming is a dynamic system. There's not going to be a single answer. And I think for those of us in the agricultural community, we see that every day. But often, I correct me if I'm wrong, but in an urban environment, everybody just really wants to solve this problem and have one solution. And unfortunately, there is not one solution, but there are a lot of great approaches. And so for diversity in the field, it's actually getting better. So there's not only more crop rotation, and maybe Michael can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I was coming of age, we all learned about this very serious fungal disease on corn, because all the corn farmers planted the exact same variety, and everything was taken down in the 1970s. Now, most growers of corn, they'll plant different varieties in different parts of their field. So even within one farm, they'll plant different varieties. So it is changing. I think it is getting better, but absolutely we need to do a lot more. And I agree, a lot faster on soil is a critical aspect. And whether or not you like herbicides, well, no one wants to spray anything. But if you are spraying herbicides, there has been a correlation with the use of these herbicide-tolerant crops and no-till farming, which really sequesters carbon in the soil. And the current scientific thought that it's very beneficial for enhancing soil fertility. So it's something unexpected. I don't think that was not the goal when herbicide-tolerant crops were developed. Farmers just wanted to, find some non-toxic approach to control weeds. But this was a really unexpected but very exciting effect that farmers are doing no-till farming, which means they don't have to roll their tractors back and forth and back and forth and use all that energy and all that fuel and disrupt the soil matter. So every major scientific organization in the world, whether the European Food Safety Authority, National Academy of Science, the World Health Organization, has concluded, you know, very narrowly and modestly that the crops currently on the market are safe to eat and that the process of genetic engineering is no more risky than other methods of genetic modification. And so we've been using genetic engineering in drugs, in medicines, and plants for over 40 years. There hasn't been a single case of harm to human health or the environment. But that doesn't say that every application is always going to be, you know, harmless and beneficial. But we can look on a case-by-case basis. And these are the same, when I say major scientific organizations, I can list them off, but maybe it's more helpful just to say that these are the exact same organizations that most of us trust when it comes to other important issues such as the changing climate and the safety of vaccines. So one important thing is to keep in mind is you can't really pick and choose your science, right? Like, you either need to have some kind of trust. It comes to trust. Like, okay, I'm a scientist, but I don't know all aspects of science, so I trust the major scientific organizations. I'm very comfortable with conclusions of the National Academy of Sciences, whether it's on genetics or climate change or vaccine safety. So I think in a way that's helpful is because it's impossible for every one of us consumers to know the answer to every scientific question. I mean, we have to have some faith in our institute.
Well, what I'm struck by is the power of the arguments here and the emotion with which they are being expressed. I mean, that's the thing. Still, no one's really dealing with that. I mean, I see it all the time in the rooms that I go into. And the question is, why is it so intense? Why are some people so pissed off? What's going on? And the question, I'm really looking for someone to explore that more deeply and offer a pathway for a resolution, because it's not only in this area, it's in politics, it's everywhere.
I didn't have any trouble with the fact that IFT was funding your film, because I know that, and the food technologists were happy to say, we want someone that gets the final cut, because they knew you were going to do an honest job, but they knew the science was on their side. So they wouldn't
that makes
even...
sense. That
they
makes
wouldn't
sense. Yeah,
sweat
true.
It because...
Well,
I,
they sweated it, trust me.
Did they?
Oh, fuck yeah. Excuse my language. Oh,
that's
yeah.
Right.
Oh,
well, it's a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. They were. They didn't want to make a GMO movie. They were terrified of making a GMO. Why would they want to go somewhere where everybody that's gotten near it has gotten burned? So I give them a great deal of credit that they were brave enough to let a filmmaker make an independent film about GMOs.
So when IFT approached you, was it to do just a movie about the future of food sort of thing?
It was that broad, yeah. Like I said, their
and
umbrella
the, and
was
you
huge.
Narrowed them down to GMO.
That's right.
And you felt, when you looked at all the stuff that you could talk about on food, what made you think, okay, I want this? I mean, it's kind of like a moth going to flame, because you mentioned, I heard you talk about the fact that you have people who are going to hate your... for taking it on, even, because it's so
controversial. Yeah, but I've gotten a lot more people that loved me and thanked me for telling the truth about science. We're living in such an age of distrust and chaos that, I don't know if you know who Jordan Peterson is. He's a professor from the University of Toronto, and he said he got into a kerfuffle about gender issues and things like that, and he says, are we rolling?
Yeah, we're sure.
In a time of chaos, our shield and our sword, I can do that, our shield and our sword is to tell the truth. Right? That's it.
Yeah.
That's all we have in a time of chaos, in a time of Trump, and a time of people calling me a propagandist. All I can do is try and continue to tell the truth. Does the truth shift? Sure, but there's still.
You guys have a great evening.
Thanks, brother. Keep those movies coming. So it was as I said on stage, I didn't take the decision to do it lightly. I took it very, very lightly. I took it very, very seriously. But it just seemed very, very worthy. It seemed and an exciting story, right? I mean, I am a filmmaker, right? I'm not a science activist.
So you made this decision. You're going to do this film about GMOs.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I mean, what have you learned that didn't make it to the film?
Interesting. What did I learn that didn't make it into the film?
Or maybe makes it a next film or something. I mean, what has you scratching your head?
It's what your friend... Are you a friend with Mike?
He is my friend.
Yeah. When he said the line, when was the last time you changed your mind, how much that struck him, I've come to use the term confirmation bias is a bitch, right? That how hard it is for us to see outside of our bubbles because of confirmation bias, because we want to see things that support our worldview, right?
Yeah.
We send our children to public schools in Los Angeles, and we actually fought off a charter school that was trying to take over that school. And I don't have a problem with what charter schools were supposed to be, but I didn't want them to take over this very good school and turn it into something else. So did I see evidence to support me sending my kid to school where somebody else would be seeing evidence to support presenting my kids to a public school, and somebody else would see evidence supporting them sending them to a charter school? So we have to be very careful and look at the whole picture. Life is really, really complicated.
Were you surprised, though, how many people kind of quickly came to the idea that they really weren't against the technology? Because when you see your film, some of the people that are supposed to be against GMOs, they really weren't against genetic engineering. They were against pesticides, and they were against herbicides, and they were against overuse of Roundup, but it didn't seem like they necessarily were against the technology.
Some of them would disagree with you. That woman who stood up and
yelled
at me.
She was yelling.
She was yelling. So I don't know how to tackle that.
Well, she was
exactly,
even saying glyphosate. Her big issue was glyphosate, which, fine.
Well,
maybe
she's
we shouldn't.
Wrong. Scientifically, it's even though I love our state of California and how far ahead we are of the world in terms of defending the environment, the glyphosate label is a fail. It's a waste of our money that we put that on there, because it's just not, in terms of risk assessment, it's a fail. There are much larger things that we need to be concerned about than for the safety of my children. Sorry, boss. Did you have a question? Oh, that's not the wrong guy. Go ahead.
But the only thing I was going to say is that glyphosate is Roundup, which, I mean, I've got it in my garage. Everybody I know's got it.
Oh.
And I don't. We don't live 100 miles from a cornfield. We
grow
everything else in the world.
Weeds.
There's nobody around here.
Yeah.
But glyphosate, you know, there's all kinds of pesticides and herbicides people use, not just on a cornfield.
Sure.
So anyway, it's...
And the ones that are used, as Ted pointed out, how many are used in organic farming that are more toxic than glyphosate, but nobody talks about that. And that's not to say that we should be afraid of the organic practices, because I believe that the people that are doing that farming are doing their best to use the safe amount of those pesticides. But let's not fool ourselves that they aren't being used in organic farming as well.
Well, just a couple quick questions then. I know this is it's been great. A very successful evening. Had a crowd, and I heard many people saying they really enjoyed it, got a lot out of the film. But I think as it's over with, and you're out now kind of taking the victory tour here in a way, because you're going around and people that are giving you...
beat up in a few places, too, but go ahead.
So I'll still yell at you.
It's been an honor.
But so thinking ahead.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, this is the story I got, and I got it out on film. People are seeing it right now.
Yeah.
What might be next? I mean, if you were able to do another film...
Sure.
What are some of the ideas that occur to you that think, boy, it'd be nice if we could go into this next?
Fair enough, yeah. The anti-vaxxer movement feels very worthy. It's a little redundant in a way to the GMO story, because it's about misinformation and bad science.
Anti-vaxxer
movement, the fact that how many people are using bad information to decide not to vaccinate their children.
Sure.
It's a shame, and I'm very proud, then again, of our state that we passed a law that children can't go to public schools if they haven't had their vaccines, and there's still a lot of people that are trying to dodge that. That's one I'm considering, but I'm not a science filmmaker. There's other science ideas out there that I hope I can make as well. But my next film right now is about race and adoption, really complicated issues on what is a family and what's a good parent, what's a bad parent. So I just like trying to find interesting, fascinating, complicated stories.
Well, and then the final question I have for you. About what has made you feel best about this whole journey you've been on? It took a long time to do a film like this.
Sure.
And you've gotten feedback, and you've got some people yell at you, and some people accuse you of propaganda, and others praising you and saying you really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
But what stuck with you?
What stuck with me are the scientists. The number of scientists that have come up. Pam Ronald just told me a young scientist came up to her in tears saying, thank you for making this movie, that she's been waiting for a film like this. So the number of scientists who's taken it on the chin and have been humble and quiet and are now starting to be more active and vocal, as we've seen even with things like the March for Science. But to be able to give voice to them has been a great honor. And it wasn't one... I've made films about oppressed people that needed a light shown on them before, and I didn't know that scientists needed it as much. And it's been wonderful to learn that, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, I tell you what, I think we're proud of people that will take the courage, I think, to get out there and tell a story like this and talk about food and agriculture. And, you know, you've done a tremendous film. It's very comprehensive, and I think it's got a lot of... There are some people that won't be persuaded one way or the other. But there's a lot of people that said, okay, well, now that makes sense.
You saw it in the room.
You did.
We had about 75 people that were scared before and about 7 after.
Well, it sounds... You got to keep this show on the road. Scott?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.